Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. Michael Adams here, coming to you with another Rugby League Digest Rewind. The 18th chapter in the Super League War will be out next week. By the time most of you are listening to this, we will have recorded it. In the meantime, we've strung together a few of our early history corners, which have nothing to do with Super League, but it was really fun for me to listen back to these. So I think if you haven't heard these before, there'll be a lot of interesting content matter for you. The first one we're putting out is, it goes for about 6 minutes. It is a story on the evolution of the kicking tee in rugby league. I particularly wanted to play this just because of how incomplete and how ultimately inconsequential it was. When we started this show in 2017, Andrew and I didn't really know what format it would ultimately be, other than we definitely didn't want to just recap 8 games and preview 8 more. We didn't envision it at the time ending up the way it has become. But this, and listening to this early history corner, it makes me think back longingly in a time when I could just gather a few random facts and tell them and be done with it. Not have to spend the next year of my life investigating every single aspect of this matter. So to me, it takes me back to a much simpler time in my life. Above all, it's very rugby league. So that will be coming out first. Then we are going to play a history corner we did on Warren Ryan's time coaching the Newcastle Knights. This is the best thing about Warren Ryan. So I've already done one on his Newcastle years. We talked a lot about him in our Bullfrog chapters, but we've just barely scratched the surface of Warren Ryan. Like, you could make an argument that the next series we do after Super League should be Warren Ryan from start to finish, because he is absolutely one of the most interesting, most captivating characters in rugby league history. I'm obsessed with the Wok. And finally, the history corner we did on the origins of the Immortals. And this is another one that is a personal favorite of mine. It's a subject that, in the course of doing our weekly show, Andrew and I talked about all the time. So it was really important to give it this grounding. And again, just a very rugby league story. Just before we do throw to these history corners, I just want to issue a content warning, and this can be applied to any time we may use some of this old stuff. Andrew and I were a lot more liberal in the language we used in the early days of the podcast. That's something we cleaned up somewhere along the way. So, just be warned if you are listening with kids in the car or you have particularly sensitive ears, there are quite a few swears in the course of those 3 history corners. So with that, we'll throw straight to it. I'll catch up with you at the end, and I hope you enjoy it.
As I mentioned, I'm doing a lot of research at the moment, and I'm coming up with a lot of content that really encapsulates why I love rugby league and why it's occasionally so frustrating to be a rugby league fan. And one issue which you wouldn't think would draw this ire and just make me laugh a lot is the evolution or the development of the kicking tee.
Love it.
So, by my accounts, Hazem El Masri era really brought it into fashion. Prior to that, it was largely the mound of dirt.
Well, let's go back before that. before that, it was a bloke holding it with his finger.
Yeah, yeah, and the digging it into the dirt.
All right. Even as a kid, I'd see guys digging a hole in the dirt and putting the ball in it. How could that possibly help a goal kicker?
Yeah.
Half the ball's buried, for Christ's sake.
Well, that's like, anytime you want to talk about, oh, Hazem El Masri, best kicker of all time, Keith Barnes dug the ball into the ground, kicked it 60 metres, you know? Like,
so he was a toe poker, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
So I don't get this. So you dig your heel in like a horse's hoof.
Yeah.
I mean, an actual horse's hoof. Ray Warren. And then the ball sits in it with its pointy end down in the ditch. So how do you toe poke the point if it's in the ditch?
I think it's close to vertical is how it works.
Oh, so they toe poked it in the middle of the ball.
I think so, yeah.
Because in the 80s and 70s, they were toe poking the point of the ball.
Point, yeah. I'll have to go back and look at some footage.
I think you're right, actually. I think they do toe poke the middle of the ball, or just under.
Yeah.
Crazy.
But anyway, so I'm going to take you back to 1954. The previous year, an American team came out and played a series of matches against, New South Wales, Sydney, Queensland. They did the whole circuit, played a lot of country games.
In rugby league.
This is a story for another day. It's a great yarn in itself. But I'm going to focus on one of the aftermaths of that. This is from the Rugby League News of the 18th of September 1954. Kickers who have trouble digging holes these days would appreciate an innovation in American gridiron. There, a rubber tee is used for kickoffs, and the ball placed on the tee without waste of time. Of course, so much time is lost otherwise that a little more would not matter, but apparently this idea suits the kickers. So they've seen these tees and they're like, oh, this is interesting. You know, they don't miss a chance to lay the boot into NFL while they're doing it. But one funny thing about this American tour, which I'll talk about it in another episode, but the New South Wales Rugby League, the controlling body at the time, were so pumped at the idea that they could capture America, and so clueless. They were like, their quotes were like, "It has a chance to really take off in America, given it's so much more exciting and such a better game than NFL."
Nothing's ever changed, is it?
But so I'll take you to May the next year, and there's obviously been a lot of talk in the boardroom about these kicking tees and whether
over a couple of schooners, you're
yeah. A decision on whether a rubber tee to assist goal kickers is to be made by the league tomorrow night. One of the major problems for the league committee will be what to do with the tee after kicks and who is responsible for looking after it. The point is where the time saved in digging a hole can offset the trouble the retrieving of the gadget after kicks will be. The committee meeting must have been favourable because the following month they've said, "Rubber tees for goal kicking will be on trial at the Domain next Wednesday, when New South Wales members of the Board of Control will see them used in a public service match. Cam Davis, who is to referee the game, has not yet worked out who is to be custodian of the gadgets. Says the job looks like being one of the ball boys."
Can you imagine how funny it would be to read the minutes of these minutes? It would be like fucking Oscar Wilde or something. Genius.
But here's what I want to get to, okay? So 1954, they're digging the hole into the ground and toe-poking it from a hole in the ground. 1999... we get plastic kicking tees. And obviously the decision to not go 50 years earlier was because they couldn't work out who was going to hold the tee when it wasn't in use, okay? But at some point in the in the 4 decades between these two events, they've decided that a better solution was to get a big bucket of sand, put it on the sideline, have it filled up with smaller buckets of sand by ball boys and take that out every time a goal's kicked.
There's nothing more I really than this. I mean, I do miss the sand.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
One of my passions as a kid, like my nan used to live across the road from a primary school, Birriban Primary School in Toronto, and I used to go there and dig the shit out of their ground and build mounds out of the dirt and kick goals all day.
Yeah.
And then word got round to my school, which is a different part of the town. The principal's after the kid has been digging all the holes because we play them in soccer. And I said, "Oh, really? Hope we catch the bastard." You know? But anyway, so I used to love kicking off sand. I thought it was great.
Mm.
Just to have a water bottle there to wet it and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's so funny to have them carrying buckets of sand instead of a fucking bit of plastic.
I don't know. It's it's bizarre to me.
That's the funniest story ever. But can you imagine how funny the discussions on everything in these meetings would have been? Even to this day.
Yeah.
Like, it would be like, imagine the Parramatta minutes.
Yeah.
All right. We had a fifth coup in 5 years. We're expected to turn this around. Can we keep doing the same thing we've always done? Yep. Hear, hear.
So turning to History Corner, I'm keeping it a bit more modern than I usually do because I wanted to talk about someone we're both big fans of, Warren Ryan, and specifically his stint at Newcastle. So he took over from Mal Riley for the start of the 99 season. And I remember even at the time it was kind of ridiculed and he was viewed as this like over-the-hill dinosaur.
I was over the moon when I heard he was coming.
Really?
But the Mal Riley love affair was a bad start for him to begin with. But Newcastle people love Mal Riley. He can walk in there now and they carry him on their shoulders to an outrageous extent.
Yeah, yeah.
Because after the grand final, they didn't do so well.
So Watt comes in, age 57, and the way the media talked about him, it was like they were bringing Vic Hay to coach him. Like this hilarious scribe at the Newcastle Herald said, his new nickname is The Wedding Singer. The blockbuster movie of the same name is set in the 80s.
Blockbuster. Which journal was that?
It didn't have a byline. Oh. It was just Newcastle Herald stuff. Warren Ryan didn't do himself any favours. Early in the 2000 preseason, Darren Albert had his, for the second year in a row, had an accident falling off his motorbike. and the article that I read went, Newcastle Knights coach Warren Ryan has christened his increasingly accident-prone winger, Biggles. Biggles, of course, referring to the series of books first published in 1932.
Let's not forget that he got sacked from ABC for quoting a scene from Gone with the Wind. a real classicist.
But before we move on to the Warren Ryan at Newcastle era itself, one thing that struck me was how, in some ways, it's a very different scenario to how it is now. So Warren Ryan was 57 and was viewed as a dinosaur. Wayne Bennett, 67. Bellamy's 57. Neil Henry and Hasler are both 56.
How is Bellamy 57? He looks great.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks younger than Martin and Navratilova, which he looks exactly like.
But so that's changed because with the exception of Bennett, no one really views those guys as really old school or of the past. But I think the thing that hasn't changed is, so Warren Ryan last coached in 94. That was his last year at West. So 5 years out of the game, I think that had more of a thing than the actual age. Mm. Like, the game just passes you by so quickly.
Absolutely.
Like, if someone tried to highlight Tim Shanes or Brian Smith just that few years out of the game.
Absolutely.
Like,
Phil Economides.
Poor Blake.
One of the legendary performances. Yeah. We've talked about it many times personally. The top eight finish with the Gold Coast Chargers. Christ.
Yeah.
Genius performance.
What did he do after that? Did he go to England?
I don't know. I'd like to look into that. If anyone knows Phil, hit us up on the Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear that.
Mm. So 99, Warren Ryan takes over at Newcastle. And on top of the age thing, there was a lot of worry that Ryan was going to put the shackles on the Johns boys.
The amount of times I heard the phrase "put the shackles on" in that year, I've never forgotten it.
Yeah. Any regular listeners to this show will know where we're heading with this, but here's one quote from the time. Steve Mortimer led the entertainers, as Canterbury were known. They were the crowd favourites. Ryan took over. All of a sudden, there were shackles on Mortimer, and the razzle dazzle was gone. Because of course, what came in then? The Dogs of War.
I was just over the moon when he came. I'm an unabashed Warren Ryan admirer. I love him, non-ironically and ironically.
Yeah,
because of his belligerent behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
But the guy is an innovator. You cannot tell a story of rugby league without him.
No.
He's a Hall of Fame worthy coach.
Absolutely.
Just an agitator too. Absolute prick of a bloke.
We'll get into all the players and coaches and media personalities he's fallen out with over the years. But you mentioned an innovator, and I think that's a really important thing to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in the Dogs of War era, it's not like he loved that style. He was exploiting the rules as they were at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a quote where he's talking, where he's rubbishing the idea that he was going to put the shackles of on the Johns boys and try to, you know, get Peter Tunks back in the fold. He said, "If you trace the history of that rubbish, it's wrong. Harry Bath was trying to tell everyone in the 70s that there wasn't enough room in which to play the game, but no one listened. By the middle of the 80s, it was clear to everyone that evolution had taken us down a dead end. The defence was simply too good for the attack. They brought in the 10-metre rule and penalised the hell out of anyone who was holding down." So, yeah, Warren Ryan was one of the key reasons for those changes being made. But if that's the rules and you want to win premierships...
Absolutely. I mean, and the players you got at your disposal as well. He had Sinek Gillespie and Lee, yeah. You know.
Yeah. One thing he didn't do was put the shackles on. Like the Knights, you know, were one of the best teams to watch in that era.
I mean, you couldn't turn Matthew Johns into a defensive 5'8". Yeah. It's impossible.
Yeah. But he took the job at a really bad time for the Knights. So he had all the drugs dramas, yeah, with O'Davis, Wayne Richards, McDougall.
And let me just bring that up. I brought up with my mate on Sunday, which on the footy show with him. It's Mad Dog's just got a complete pass from being a drug cheat.
Well, having read a few articles about it in the last couple of days, I think the medical excuse was genuine.
I love Mad Dog, don't get me wrong, but the whole family's been embroiled in drug
issues.
Doesn't mean the brother's guilty for the brother's sins, but
yeah, no.
It just doesn't look good.
Yeah.
And no one mentions it.
Yeah.
Now, Davis hasn't really got away with it.
I hated that at the time. I hate how Wayne Richards like got the sack. I was fine with him getting the sack, don't get me wrong. Wayne Richards gets the sack, has a middling year at South before heading over to England.
Mm-hmm.
Robbie O'Davis is back playing Origin one game after his...
Yep.
And no one talks about it. He's just forgiven.
Yep. You know?
Rodney Howe's a pariah to this day.
Absolutely. It's weird.
Although Howe played Origin soon after he came back. But the first thing you associate with Rodney Howe is drug cheat.
Thanks to Gordy.
Yeah. Robbie O'Davis... It's hardly mentioned.
I remember reading Gordy's book and how angry he was still in the book. Like,
yeah.
I love Gordy for that.
Yeah.
But, it's peculiar. I mean, Mad Dog's on the panel at the footy show. Everyone loves him. He's got a man shake.
Yeah, yeah.
Always forgiven, always forgotten. They're never even brought up.
So basically, the story goes that he fractured his skull or something in like 93. I can't remember whether it was playing footy or otherwise. But that caused this... hormonal imbalance. I think it had something to do with his pituitary gland, that he wasn't producing enough testosterone.
Yeah, I remember the story, yeah. It's a fair excuse.
Yeah.
But I mean, given the circumstantial evidence around it, no good.
Yeah. But anyway.
Bad time for Walker to show up is the
bottom line. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then on top of that, there was unrest at the club and money issues. This is the most Newcastle thing ever. So I'll just read you this. This was a fundraising drive to actually get the fans to pay for players' contracts.
I remember it.
Retired club captain Paul Harrigan and coach Warren Ryan kicked off the Club 2000 campaign at the Knights Leagues Club. Ryan said the fighting fund would help keep rival clubs at bay. For $2,000, supporters or sponsors can buy a limited edition gold ring, which avails them of other benefits.
Can you imagine? Can you fund the sport that you love?
It's so Newcastle. Like when they decided they weren't going to re-sign Matthew Johns.
That was the funniest thing ever. There was a mob outside West Leagues going, "Come out and face us."
Were you in Newcastle at that time?
What year was that?
That was 2000.
No, I was in London, but I remember reading about it and cracking up.
And then what's the John's dad name?
Gary Johns.
Gary Johns. This is from Andrew Johns' autobiography. Dad became really outspoken about it and was being quoted in the newspapers and getting into a war of words with Warren Ryan. To be honest, it gave me the shits. The old man got up and spoke, telling the crowd I was 100 to 1 to re-sign and that Warren Ryan could burn in hell.
That's very Newcastle. And let's look at the scoreboard. Warren Ryan gets rid of Matty in 2000.
Yeah.
When did they win the comp?
Yeah, yeah.
2001.
Exactly. And, okay, so they're knocked out first week of the finals in 99. He takes them to the prelim in 2000. They should have won that game. They choked against East. I mean, they probably would have been cannon fodder for the Broncos the next week anyway. But on field, like, it was a successful era.
Absolutely.
And some terrible recruitment. So you have to apportion some blame to Warren Ryan for that. Brought in Steve Walters, who lasted about five games.
That was a disaster, yeah.
It was a disaster, but apparently he was basically on match payments. So, yeah.
But having a legend around can help, as you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just to help the young blokes and stuff. Yeah. So maybe he was doing that, who knows.
Yeah. But Ben Kennedy aside, they brought in a succession of pretty terrible players. Matt Parsons was all right, I guess.
Yeah, he did well.
Yeah.
Role player.
Yeah. And as so often it happened, it all kind of fell apart. Warren Ryan lost the room, which didn't help when basically his first role when he got to Newcastle was to tell the players that they only won half a comp.
Such a maverick.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the word you hear about him all the time is abrasive, and there's no better word to describe him.
Yeah.
But wantonly abrasive.
Yeah.
No attempt to sugarcoat anything. And I admire it. I admire the belligerence.
The best quote I saw was from Greg Pritchard. He said, "He doesn't just call it a spade. He tries to hit you with it."
Well, Phil Rothfield, I used to write into his blog and ask questions when he had the Telegraph blog when he first had the Question Time sort of thing. And he told me, I said, "What do you think of Wok?" And he goes, "When I was a cadet journalist, I was waiting for a story for him. And I said, 'Hello, Mr. Ryan.' And he knocked my book out of my hand and walked away." Something like that. It's fucking outrageous.
I love this story. So he placed a media ban on Ray Hadley in 2UE, but Ray Hadley, in typical Ray Hadley style, was trying to say that, no, it was he who banned Warren Ryan.
Imagine those two together in a room. Fuck it, oh.
But that leads us to the biggest story of this year. So he had a fight with Roy Masters. And apparently when Roy Masters was coaching West in the late 70s, that was Warren Ryan's first Sydney gig. He was coaching the under-23s or something like that. And they nearly came to blows on multiple occasions in that era. So it's just this like 20-year-long slanging match.
Just the ability to come to blows at will.
Yeah. So it all culminated at the grandstand in Parramatta Oval. I'll read you Roy Masters' version first, then I'll read you Warren Ryan's. So Masters said, "I was king hit on the side of the head by Ryan while he was standing above me on the steel steps at the back of the western grandstand of Parramatta Oval." Love the detail. "Ryan was aggrieved at an article I wrote 5 years ago during Ryan's last year at West."
Very aggrieved.
And Ryan's version was, "I started telling him pretty frankly what I thought of some of his journalistic efforts, and I don't think that was exactly music to his ears. I pushed him out of the way, and those ridiculous glasses that he wears on the point of his nose fell off." My favourite thing is, so Paul McGough, who's like been a like foreign correspondent for the Herald for like 15 years or so, it's got to be the same Paul McGough, but I saw a he wrote an article in defense of Roy Masters, who was his, you know, stablemate at Fairfax. So this is the semi-neutral, although biased in Masters' favors version. Ryan told Masters that he hadn't answered one of Masters' questions at a recent post-match conference because he objected to an article Masters had written saying it was time for Ryan to quit coaching and smell the roses. As Masters was pointing out that the offending article had been written 5 years ago, Ryan punched him on the side of the face, knocking off Ryan's glasses.
Now, out of those two, I'd take Ryan Masters' version.
Yeah.
If I was a magistrate, I'd say Warren Ryan's memory might be a bit cloudy. first of all, I love Ryan Masters' journalism. Mm. The fact that he's a rugby league coach from the Fibro Silvertails era, yeah. And he's so eloquent.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, such integrity.
Yeah.
And stands by his beliefs and stuff.
Yeah.
I'd definitely take his version, definitely.
Yeah.
King hitting people. It's a fucking outrage.
And he's still up to it these days. He got like arrested last year for assault because he got in a fight with someone about Donald Trump.
No, not someone. An elderly senior citizen, which he himself is as well.
And so it was a really combative couple of years for Warren Ryan and the Sydney Press, or any press really. Like, he banned Newcastle Herald journalists, you know, he banned 2UA. And he walked out of a press conference one time and he said, "I told you I wasn't going to take any further part in a pantomime."
Just the character. We don't have these guys anymore.
No, no. And I loved him as a commentator too.
Me too. He was like, blunt.
He was so blunt. He
didn't sit on the fence.
Like, I remember one time, like, I can't remember which club Willie Mason was at this point, but whoever he was playing for was on an attacking raid and Willie Mason's fucked up, as is his wont. And Warren Ryan said something to the effect of, they had all the space and big dumb Willie dropped it.
I think he might have a few racial issues dealing with internally as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what undid
him. I did like his sticking to his guns to the end, his refusal to apologize for that. It would be insincere, so I'd rather just retire.
Yeah, I mean,
just total personal code.
Yeah, whatever you want to say about, you know, the incident himself, there's something you got to respect about just saying, no, it'll be a hollow apology, so I'm not going to do it. See you later. It's very Mossop Way-esque.
Isn't it? That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's my way or the highway. Mm.
But so one article I read gave a list of some of his falling outs over the years. So Tommy Radonikis at Wests, Steve Mortimer, Jason Taylor, Roy Masters, Peter Frelengos, Paul Langmack, Wayne Pearce, Matthew Johns, Tony Butterfield.
Fell in butts, did he?
Yeah, yeah. So Johns and Butterfield organised a players-only dinner, which is another great rugby league thing to do when you're not happy with your coach. And, they were demanding he treated them better.
It's just amazing he got the results he did with the personality that he possesses.
Yeah, yeah.
The abrasiveness must have worked in some ways, but it's not going to last long.
Yeah, I mean, he took Newtown to the grand final 81.
Amazing. With
like Tommy Radonikis and Phil Gould, a couple of good players, but basically,
But let's not forget that Gould was the coach he was because of Warren.
Yeah, yeah.
I was reading on his Wikipedia earlier how he was a Commonwealth Games shot putter.
Yeah, yeah.
And he attributes his attention to detail and coaching to his Czech shot put coach.
Mm. And think about how many coaches played under Ryan.
Yeah.
Like, it's an endless list.
Almost like the coaches that come out of Canberra. It's just a production line.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it must have been great.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. It's just, I don't know. It's a really nice era to look back on that couple of years.
We're a bit young to really feel the force of his Dogs of Warrior and stuff like that. But
yeah,
I remember him with Wes. But the results speak for himself. Every club he took them from middle of the road or better to challenging for the grand final.
Yeah, yeah. And you talk about him falling out with players, but how many players left Canterbury to go to West?
But how many... West hadn't had any success since God, Christ knows when, and then they were a formidable side.
Yeah, yeah. Him.
Mm. Incredible.
So we love Warren Ryan, if that wasn't clear. I'm sure there'll be plenty of Warren Ryan talk as the show goes on.
And the nickname as well.
Yeah.
I want to know the origin of the nickname.
Yeah, yeah. But I feel kind of like, you know, Christopher Columbus trying to discover China and ending up in the Bahamas. So I'm like researching Warren Ryan, the Newcastle era, and I've stumbled upon something pretty momentous. And I'm just going to read it out to you. As if he didn't have enough to worry about right now, Matthew Johns broke his hand during Newcastle's win over North Queensland yesterday. But the hand's owner, who looked like Matthew Johns, played like Matthew Johns, and wore the Knights' number 6 jersey, would answer only to the name Reg Reagan. I said to the boys that I've invented myself an alter ego, Johns/Reagan said. When I don't feel like coming to training, I just lay in bed and send him along. He's a late 1970s Australian, loves going to the beach, hates sunscreen, smokes only Winfield Red, drinks full-strength beer. This was in 2000. I just wanted to throw that out there.
And what a comedy genius it become.
We're going to talk about something we talk about a lot, which is the Immortals. And for all we talk about it, I think it's a very problematic award. I kind of wish we didn't have to talk about it. But what you can't deny is what a success it's been. And in many ways, it was a very unlikely success. So I want to just unpack the origins of the Immortals and have a look at how we got to where we are today.
This will be good for me. I mean, you've given me the odd overview of this, but to hear it in detail for me will be awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in my view, it's not only a great award, it's the Immortals of awards.
Yeah, yeah. So when the 8th Immortal was inducted, which turned out to be Andrew Johns in 2012, the great Ian Heads, who's, what can you say about Ian Heads? What a legend of rugby league he is. First ballot journo rugby league Hall of Fame. So he was Rugby League Week editor at the time. So he was like right involved with the planning of the Immortals and all of that. And he said, it was a concept which has grown in stature into something never even faintly contemplated those 31 years ago, which is really appropriate because I didn't realize until a few years ago that it started as a promotion for Port.
Think about that. Port.
So I'll read you more of Ian Head's description of the origins of the Immortals.
Is there a more rugby league drink than port?
There is not. So, again, this was from his 2012 address to induct Joey Johns. Like many of the best innovations, it was, back then, an idea plucked out of thin air. First thoughts belonged to John Fordham, and quite possibly over a longish lunch, considering that his companion was a robust individual who grew to become a legend of the wine industry, Brian McGuigan. Most of you probably know the story of Fordham outlining to McGuigan the value that lay in a commercial involvement of his growing wine business with the game of rugby league. So, long lunch, McGuigan and Fordham talking about, you know, if there was anything they could do to merge.
Wine. How old must have John Fordham been?
Yeah, like couldn't have been that old, eh?
Yeah. But he's been involved in every significant thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Since then.
Mm. So then the idea was born. McGuigan and Fordham took it to Ian Heads. Ian Heads brought Zorba into the mix because he was the New South Wales editor at the time.
How did it succeed? There must have been a few crates of wine falling off the back of trucks or something.
Well, get this. This is a contested assertion because John Fordham thinks it played out differently. But Ian Heads said that Zorba was actually the one that came up with the term Immortals.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm flabbergasted that Zorba is involved in something successful.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, but the funny thing is that the word immortal has a much longer association with rugby league. Rugby League News, which you've heard me mention on the show many times, it's the precursor to Big League, was the official publishing organ of the New South Wales Rugby League from 1920 to 1973 when it became Big League. In the early 50s, they had a column called Immortal where every week they'd shine a light on a former player. So I like that touch. I don't know if that was a conscious thing at the time, but so the word immortal has a long association.
It must have been in the psyche of the conspirators.
Yeah, yeah. Ian Hentz was good enough to grant me an interview last year, and I actually asked him what came first, the port promotion or the idea for the Immortals. and he couldn't give me like a clear answer. I think the truth is lost in that long lunch at Double Bay or wherever it might have been. But yeah, so in the past week, I've gone back and read through those Rugby League Week issues in the lead up to the announcement of the award to try to get a sense of, was it a real award with an alcohol promotion, or was it an alcohol promotion with an award attached to it?
Either way.
And so it's murky. It's murky. I can't say one way or the other.
Be like saying like the fucking Oscar started off as a promotion for Kahlua or something.
So to be fair, Rugby League Week did talk about it as a real honour, and you know, this is going to crown the best players since the Second World War. But it was a subsidiary of McGuigan's called Elliott's Wines. The mention of Elliott's Wines was never far away from the surface when they were talking about the Immortals. So I'll just read this from 6 weeks before the Immortals were crowned. Four weeks. At a meeting in Sydney 2 weeks ago, a distinguished panel of judges made their choice of the four greatest players of the post-war era. Those four players will be honoured in a magnificent promotion by leading Hunter Valley winemakers Elliott's. A superb box set of four bottles of Elliott's 1977 vintage port, paying homage to the four greats, will be released on July the 2nd. The wines will carry biographies and pictures of the four players, accompanied by scrolls telling their stories. We at Rugby League Week regard this as an event of great prestige for the game of rugby league. The port series, the Immortals, will quickly become a collector's item.
Unbelievable.
Enthusiasm for the award was built with the addition of a reader prize, where if you wrote in and guessed the same Immortals that the panel of experts did, prizes include a trip to London and then minor prizes of a weekend at the Hunter Valley and lunch at Brian McGuigan's estate.
I can't believe it. I really hope that Chuck and Clive Churchill got a whole bunch of port out of this.
Oh, they received editions 1 through 4 of the commemorative port. The judging panel, who I will name shortly because they play a big part in my story, they received 5 through 7. There were 3 judges.
I reckon Chooks was gone first night.
And apparently the issue where the Immortals were announced sold 80,000 copies. So there was a lot of buzz about it, and I think the game was crying out for something like this. But even in the immediate aftermath, I can't fully establish what was more known, the advertisement or the Immortals. I know the box set of port is an immortal of the alcohol sales game, taking its place along other immortals such as Tui's Draft Twist Top, $7.99 a case, and a Long John Scotch, $10.49 a bottle. So esteemed company there in the alcohol advertisements of 1981. And there was an article the next year where a golf writer was talking about golf doing a similar thing. And I'll just read this out. Can you pick the four golden legends of Australian golf? They will be featured on the labels of a pack of four choice gold medal wines later this year. This is a follow-up to the highly successful promotion in which Rugby League's Clive Churchill, Reg Gasnier, Johnny Raper, and Bob Fulton were voted the Immortals on a wine pack. Okay, so at the moment, it's looking more like the alcohol's winning out. But then, on July 2027, so not even a full month after the announcement, we saw there could be one earlier, but in my research, the first reference to, you know, the way the Immortals is used now, it's like an OAM. You know, it's
better.
Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Like, you can't say Johnny Raper without rugby league immortal Johnny Raper. Yeah. And on July 27, the Canberra Times ran this article. Rugby league immortal Johnny Raper will be the guest of honour at a pie and footy night organised by second division club Valley Statesman. Okay, so, all right. It's not, you know, lunch at Kirribilli House. Except we're working in the field of rugby league. But from not even a month after the award was crowned,
yeah,
you're already having it added as a prefix to their names.
I'd like to know at what point it become so fixed in the lexicon that, like you'll hear someone like, someone was getting into Rothfield one day saying, oh, why are you wrapping up this guy so much? And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. So he played as Hayne. He goes, it was that big run he had. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. So next time someone plays like an immortal for fucking six straight weeks, I'm just going to ignore it, am I? And they're like, Mark Guy would say something like, this guy's attitude, he's playing like he's an immortal. You know? So it's used in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
As a benchmark.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to know when what year that kicked in.
Mm, yeah, that's a good one too. So regardless of what you want to say, it worked. You know, whether it was just a fortunate accident, you can't deny the impact it's had and how good it's been for the game ultimately. The other aspect of it I wanted to talk about was the actual voting process.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So the judges for the award were Frank Hyde, Tom Goodman, and Harry Bath.
Who's Tom Goodman?
So Tom Goodman was a journalist for the Herald, and he'd been writing about rugby league since the 20s.
Wow.
So you had Frank Hyde come of age and play in the 30s, Harry Bath in the 40s. So you had... And obviously, you know, Frank Hyde's record speaks for itself. Harry Bath as a player, as a coach, and just a real thinker of rugby league.
Yeah, perfect guy for it.
Yeah, so three guys held in the highest of regard.
Let's just have a bit of musing on this. The importance of journalists to rugby league, just the impact they've had on the game through every era. Incredible.
Yeah. Oh, like that, the Ian Head's generation, him and Alan Clarkson, Jeff Prenner,
yeah,
all these guys, you know, sadly departed Mike Gibson, and, you know.
Well, but you remember when Peter Frelingos died?
Yeah,
it was like the fucking Purpid died.
Did you know Peter Frelingos is responsible for Parramatta being called the Eels?
No?
Yeah.
How'd that work out?
So I think Parramatta, the Aboriginal word, has something to do with eels.
Right.
I could be wrong about that. I can't quite remember. But anyway, Peter Frelingos is the one that first started referring to them as that.
Wow.
Because they were one of those teams that didn't have a name when they started.
Perfect.
Yeah. Just while we're having a few asides, I was reading a few Tom Goodman articles in the lead up to this. And I found something that I think you'd like. This was a story on South Sydney legend Jack Rayner, who was a stalwart of that early 50s South dynasty. League administrators should be determined that Rayner's outstanding qualities should not be lost to the game, even when he's retired from the playing arena. So as far back as at least 1954, we were worried about losing players to the game.
It never ends.
But so we'll turn to the voting itself. If I could be anywhere in history for one night to be witness to something, this might be it. This is a lengthy quote, but I'm going to tell the story in Frank Hyde's words. So bear with me, because I think it really needs to be read in full to actually get the sense of it. It was a long and exhausting process, one of the long nights of my life, in fact. The three of us were ensconced in a city hotel. The task began about 6 p.m. The method used was as follows. Individually, we wrote out our list of the players we rated the best 100 in rugby league since World War II. We then checked the lists, each against the other, eliminate any player who was not on the three lists. Then we reduced the list to 75 players, and from that point, just kept reducing. At 2 o'clock in the morning, we were still reducing, down to 12 by that point. By the same process, i.e. that not anybody on all three lists was automatically eliminated, we reduced the numbers to 8 and then to 5. At 5, we were deadlocked. hopelessly, it seemed. At that stage, we even considered asking the organisers to make the promotion the five immortals rather than the allocated four. After some discussion, we rejected that and pressed on. At this point, with the working day near to its dawning, we changed our method. We decided that one of us would pick the four, and the other two would have to justify which of the four would be dropped if the fifth player was to be substituted. Finally, around 4 o'clock in the morning, we made the decision. One great player had been left off the final list, and we had our four immortals. I've never named the fifth immortal, and I don't plan to do so now. As far as I'm concerned, his name will remain behind the door of that room in which the three of us met that night. Suffice to say is that he was a player encompassing all the attributes of a champion, one of the all-time greats and recognised that way. But when it came down to the crunch, we debated whether we could drop Churchill, Raper, Gasnier or Fulton. We decided that we could find no reason to justify dropping any one of them in favour of the fifth player. I'm comfortable with the men we chose, although the thought of the fifth immortal and how close he got nags me now and then.
That's spine tingling.
Isn't it? Like, to have those three guys sitting in a room.
I love the gravitas they gave it, even though it was probably an alcohol
promotion. Yeah. To hear Harry Barth and Frank Hyde and Tom Goodman just sit there debating the best players they've seen, like.
So we know now from history that that was Langlands.
Yeah.
It was the fifth and one.
Yeah. So we'll get to that. I just wanted to, ever since I read that, it's been like a dream for me and you and some other dickhead to book a hotel room and like do something similar.
Well,
like
I was going to say, it reminds me of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Discussions.
Yeah. So
same sort of gravitas.
So we book a hotel room and do the same thing. 100 players, whittle the list down. Then I thought of it like, if I was to tell my wife that I was going to leave her and my son for a night to sit in a hotel room with you and talk about footy players, I think she'd rather I was cheating.
That would be awesome.
But the fifth immortal was Langlands.
It must have been tough, Fulton or Langlands.
Yeah. Well, true to his word, Hyde never talked about it, even after.
What an absolute man of integrity he was.
Yeah. Do you know, after or in the midst of his broadcasting career, he used to lead supporters groups on kangaroo tours.
Nothing makes me happier than ex-players and identities leading tours.
But 20, 30 years after, he would have an annual reunion at, I think it was like Canterbury Leagues Club, a place like that, where people, like just average punters who had been on these tours, would gather with Frank Hyde every year and talk about, you know, what a legend. Yeah.
What a legend.
Mm-hmm.
I used to look at them in the 90s and go like, but I think fucking Zorba had one.
Yeah.
I used to go like, can you imagine going on this tour and like, how much they'd be phoning it in and stuff like that? Getting on the piss and trying to fight you. But it's like, I mean, Frank Hyde, that would just, what a gentleman.
So he never revealed that it was Langlands, but Harry Barth wasn't so opposed to making that known, and he actually said it to the man himself.
Well, he was St. George, so he probably felt he owed it to him.
Well, yes and no. He and Langlands didn't have a great relationship from what I can gather.
You think he did it despite him?
I'll read out the story as Langlands tells it. We went to a Carbine luncheon when I was living up at Southport. On the way home, the lunch had been held in Brisbane. Harry Barth came and sat next to me and said, "You've got the shits because you weren't picked in the immortals." I replied that I wasn't angry and said, it's got nothing to do with me, whoever they went for. Harry then said, "It was me that didn't vote for you. I went against you." I said, "All right, fair enough." He said, "Well, the reason being is that I didn't think there should be three from the one club being in as immortals." To this day, I'd rather not know who went against me, Langland said. And this was a kind of widely known thing. A couple of quotes. This was Brian Chickamore. "When the immortals came out, I said, 'No Graham Langlands.' I was just totally amazed. Anyway, I've heard stories, as you do in football circles, that because there was already two St. George blokes and they wouldn't make a third. Also, I've heard that one of the selectors didn't particularly like Graham," which I think is probably Harry Barth. I think Harry Barth was coaching Australia in the late 60s, early 70s. And when you've got like blokes like Langlands, Smith, Artie Beetson, etc. in that team, I think if you're an old school disciplinarian like Harry Bath, you're going to...
And even that's rugby league, to have a personal vendetta impacting your decision. What about the quote? You've got the shits. Not a question, have you got the shits? A statement.
So of course, Graham Langlands did get in with Wally Lewis in 99.
Well, that was way too long. Why did they wait so long?
It's funny. I mean, yeah, I don't know. But the funny thing was, it was only supposed to be Wally Lewis. The original brief was the best player since the first Immortals were picked.
Oh, thank God they put him in.
Credit to Ken Arthurson. This is Ken Arthurson's book telling the story. So I don't know if this is the whole story. Let me
guess, it's Pro-Arco?
Yeah. So even Ken Arthurson, a bloke who would campaign for Scott Fulton if he had half a chance, he said how pleased he was to see Langlands get the nod, even if he did it with a very Arco-like self-service. He said, "I'm delighted to say that I was a part of Langlands being named an Immortal because I became a selector for the Immortals. I, along with some of the other selectors, said, well, look, we always felt there was an injustice as far as Graham Langlands is concerned, and we think we should bend the rules and include another player. And that's how Graham Langlands became an Immortal."
It's perfect, exactly how it is now.
Yeah.
That they've righted that wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the few fucking good decisions in rugby league.
Yeah, absolutely. Just something really heartwarming, especially in the wake of Gasnier's death and, you know, Langlands and Raper's diminished states. Langlands never really, if he was aggrieved, he never came out publicly and talked about it.
And that's very un-rugby league.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you're running a bar in the Philippines, it's not going to be fucking time to be aggrieved, isn't it?
But so probably about a decade or 15 years ago, he and the other St. George Immortals formed a little group called the Saints Immortals. And he said this, "It's a pity it's taken me 20 years to get into it with these other two blokes, Gasnier and Raper. What we're doing at the moment is good. We're touring the country areas and we're trying to promote the game in these areas. It's just great to be in the same room as Reg Gasnier and Johnny Raper."
Beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, as a Dragons fan, that, you know, gives me tingles.
Well, I mean, we haven't seen that much of him. That clip you put on our Facebook page recently, just incredible. Just,
yeah.
And every person that you respect in the game will just say he's one of the top seven players of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
Kevin Humphreys actually said that he thought Langlands was the best out of all of them. You know?
Well, that goes to show how good Gasnier must have been. He hasn't got the numbers, the short career with the injuries and whatever.
Mm.
He must have been fucking something else.
And this is the one of the last things I want to touch on, because Frank Hyde in his autobiography was at the end tasked with picking his four Immortals from 82 to 95 when the book was published. He picks Wally Lewis, Peter Sterling, Brett Kenny, and Gene Miles. The Gene Miles pick, I think, touches on what we're trying to do with the Hall of Fame and some of the struggles to get it right, you know. By the way, the feedback's been fantastic. We really appreciate the conversation. Let's keep it going because the criteria is a work in progress. I'm happy with the players we've put in, but the sanctity of the Hall must be preserved. but Frank said this about picking... picking Gene Miles over Meninga. "Pick the Immortals too on pure records, Meninga would be number one. But there's a lot more to football than cold records on a printed page. I came down to pure football in my choice. And for me, Miles was and is the man."
It looks like they chose pure football from the first Immortals as well.
And that's why it's so hard to just go by stats.
See, that's why if Inglis comes back and maybe wins another comp, he's an Immortal.
I think talent-wise, he is absolutely the best player I've seen. He's probably not in the top five or top 10 of best careers I've seen, but some of the things he does, ball in hand at full stride.
It's all going to depend on how he comes back.
Yeah.
He comes back and becomes the elder statesman and like just carves up Thurston-esque. He'll be an Immortal.
Just to finish up, you know, we talked at the start about trying to work out whether it was alcohol or a real award. And I think I'm going to give it to the real award because that's what it's become. And
it became a real award when you had men of that stature treating it with the respect they did.
Yeah, exactly. At the time, the port itself was billed with the following. It goes on sale to the public this week and is expected to become a collector's item for sportsmen and non-sportsmen alike. I had a look today. You can get a box set of a model sport for $75.
Original. I'm getting you that for Christmas. That's it. Done.
Yeah. So yeah, the Immortals.
Wow, that was beautiful.
Yeah. So that is this week's show. As I said, the 18th chapter in the Super League War will be out next week. We're putting together another mailbag episode, so would love to get your questions on anything we've covered in the Super League War to date. Anything you might want to know about us or putting the show together, coronavirus, whatever it is, please send your questions in either by Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or send in an email to therugbyleaguedigest@gmail.com. Of course, if you haven't joined already and you use Facebook, please jump on and join our official discussion forum, supplement the Rugby League Digest Super League War discussion forum, I believe is the full name. Please get on there and get into the conversation. So thanks for listening. Thanks for your patience as always, as we're heading to the home stretch for the first season of this Super League War. So in weeks ahead, you'll hear more about what we've got coming up, but we've got some really great stuff coming in the weeks ahead. So we will speak to you next week. See you later.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.